WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist and short story writer Barry Hanna. Larry McMurtry has called him the best fiction writer to appear in the South since Flannery O'Connor. William Styron described Hanna as an original and one of the most consistently exciting writers of the post-Faulkner generation. Hanna writes about the American South. He grew up in Mississippi and has taught for many years at the University of Mississippi. He has won the William Faulkner Prize, been nominated for an American Book Award, and was a National Book Award finalist. His latest novel, Yonder Stands Your Orphan, was just published in paperback. The title borrows a line from the Dylan song, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. There are orphans and guns in the novel and plenty of evil as a killer changes the lives of everyone around him. Hanna wrote the book while getting chemotherapy treatments for lymphoma. He's now in remission. I spoke with him last year when the book was published in hardcover. We started with a short reading.
This is Man Mortimer, who is the evil that lurks in this book, and he likes to cut people. He comes from Missouri. And there's a little piece about him. At this juncture, he had no plans to hurt people around the lake. He did not like bodies of water much, had never seen the ocean. He was indifferent to trees. Soil was hateful to him, as was the odor of fish. But like many another man, 45 years in age, he wanted his youth back. He wanted to have pals, sports, high school girls. This need had rushed on him lately. He lived in three houses, but he had no home. He did not like the hearth, smells from the kitchen, an old friend for a wife, small talk. It all seemed a vicious closet to him. He moved, he took, he was admired. But he had developed a taste for young and younger flesh. This was thrilling and meant high money. Men and women in this nation were changing, and he intended to charge them for it. Religion had neither formed nor harmed him. Neither had his parents in southern Missouri. But he despised the weakness of the church and of his parents, whom he had gulled. He was a pretty boy born of hawk-nosed people. It was a curse to have these looks and no talent. Long, lank, hooded eyes, sensual lips that sang no tune. Still, he quit the football team because of what it did to his hair, claiming a back ailment that had exempted him from manual labor since age 14. There are thousands of men of this condition, most of them sorry and shiftless, defeated at the start. Many are compulsives and snarling fools, emeritus at 20.
Is this character of Man Mortimer based on anyone?
No, he's not. He's a compound, and I've gotten, just by looking around and believing that I perceived evil in front of me. So it is imaginative, but a collected history of my impressions, I believe.
You describe him as a quiet man, a gambler, a liaison for stolen cars, and a runner of whores, including three Vicksburg housewives. Describe his kind of crime.
His kind of crime is the kind of crime that begins out of laziness and being admired by women. He finds he can make a living at it, and he continues since he ran away from home in high school. He's not been particularly violent, but he has induced violent suicides in others. He is a thief. He has a stolen car ring, especially expensive SUVs. He's a man who doesn't like to work, and he doesn't like much of what's offered by nature. So I feel him as an alien without real pals and only a commercial connection to women. He wants to join in society now, but he only knows how to hurt, and that's the base of the book. evil when it reaches out to you and when it befriends you. And in Mortimer's case, he likes to use a knife.
Why did you want to create a character who embodies evil?
I have been fascinated with how evil goes unpunished, even unseen, in this life. And I wanted the evil to work on a group of folks I have already imagined in my short stories around a beautiful lake of my youth. And I thought the evil that Mortimer represented would give each of them decisions to make. And it would give a focus to their lives. So that I suppose I am just interested in evil and what it does to folks in a community.
Has evil like Man Mortimer's kind of evil ever come into your life?
I've been around it. Usually evil is something you can't face. It simply has to wear out. Sometimes you work for evil unwittingly. And I can't think of a particular person right now, but I think I've felt the closeness of evil in casinos. And it brings out the old Baptist in me. I find the wretched excess and the sort of zombified folks that attend and participate in casinos pathetic and also dangerous in many cases.
Now, what about violence? There's some violence in this book. Has violence come into your life? Have you witnessed it? Have you ever had a violent streak yourself?
I like to throw knives back in my drinking days, but no, I've never been personally violent. I can't be an honest man, though, and tell you, but that I am occupied by violence. It seems to be out of my nightmares, and my wife wishes I wouldn't write about violence, but as soon as the pen starts going, I become interested in it all over again, and it's as if it's almost dictated to me, because I've been writing for 35 years, and it's attended a good deal of my work. At this point, I don't think I can do anything but confess that I am a student of violence because of what it does, because of how it quickens the character of those around it.
Everyone in your book is quite damaged in some way or another. Why is that?
Well, you know, I noticed the New York Times reviewer said that this book was a parade of gargoyles, and there are damaged folks in it. I think that people are needing to mend around a lake. A lake is a great contemplative body for me, and lakes have soothed me all my life. And I think that the wounded and those in despair might naturally gather around such a lake to live. I do not think my characters are particularly grotesque. It is my honest view of how folks live. And I have those fans of mine who don't really see them as terribly eccentric or painting them as obsessive. They think they're looking at life straight on. When you look at all of us, you're going to find a kind of private hurt that can be monstrous, and our private obsessions are very strange to others if they knew them. That's about all.
Now, I think you wrote most of this novel after being diagnosed with lymphoma, and some of it while taking chemotherapy treatments. Were you feeling kind of particularly damaged yourself when you were writing, physically damaged?
Yeah, and that probably contributes to the themes of damage in the book. I hadn't considered that, but my wife read the book, and she said, you know, this is very dark. And I had told a buddy of mine, very close to me, Dan Williams, you're going to have fun with this one, Dan. There's a lot of exuberance and When it was finished, it was darker than I knew. I do think I was writing out of some real obsession with mortality and physical pain and on steroids some of the time. Well, the steroids were my only energy. They're the only drug that kept me standing during the chemotherapy.
How do you think the exhaustion of being sick and taking chemo affected your will to write, your ability to write, the style that you wrote in?
You know, I really can't answer for that. I know that much came in a rush, private inner rushes, and that it was composed in tranquility that became a little more panicked and more panicked as I wrote, because I got deeper into treatment and into weakness. So it was a book that may be paced beginning with kind of a healthy or just clinical observations about folks, and then it becomes maybe more frantic.
It takes a lot of endurance to write. I mean, I think it's a pretty exhausting, mentally exhausting occupation. Physically, not so much so, because you're just sitting in a chair. Were you surprised at how much energy it took to write?
Yeah, I've never been this weak in my life, and I was shocked by weakness, which just accompanies the treatment. And I agree, it takes a lot of energy and a lot of muscular strength. I mean, I use a pencil, and I love all of these tools, but it never had occurred to me what a vast physical job writing was until this book, because in my earlier books, I had trouble keeping up with my pencil. The stories were coming so hot and heavy. In this one, this was a rather long and very exhausting view into a force that weakened me personally. I had 100 pages more than this book was, and it was cleaned up and helped beautifully by my editor, Amy Hundley, and by my wife also. My wife typed the manuscript. I was, for the first time in my life, very, very dependent on the women around me, and very beholden and full of love for these people.
We're listening to an interview recorded last summer with Barry Hanna when his novel Yonder Stands Your Orphan was published. It's just come out in paperback. He's still in remission from cancer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barry Hanna. His latest novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. There's a bar in which the novel opens. It's called the Walnut Bar. I want you to describe this bar.
This bar is one of the few surviving. I'm turning the pages now. I'm looking into what it is. It's a roadhouse, really. It's with a little bait. He's the man who still has roaches for bait, which is really unheard of since the 50s almost. But he's a wise man in the ways of fishing. He advises folks on depth and lures and the wind. He's a bard. Men come there because it has none of the trappings of a woman about it. It has a calendar of a naked, bosomy girl on the wall, and it evokes the 50s around the Korean War. So it's where men gather in different places in the South, to be men and to talk manly. And it's a rough place, but it's also kind of a church. The bar is Walnut. As far as I know, it's unnamed. And it also is unlicensed. So the sheriff allows it or disallows it to be open. What it is a mecca for fishermen. And every fisherman I know who's serious about going long distances to fish will know something about a roadhouse like this.
Whereas I know nothing about a roadhouse like this. And I don't know whether it's because I'm a woman or because I'm from the North or because I'm from the city. But, you know, I was reading this and I'm thinking, I've never had the experience of being in a bar like this.
There's no reason why you should, Terry. I wouldn't go in there if I were a woman. There's nothing attractive unless you fish and you just see a sort of rugged charm about the folks. It's pretty pathetic, really, when it's on merits. But he does have good whiskey, which he overcharges for, and he's got tales. He's telling stories about people around the lake. So he is kind of the Homer of the place. And the people are disappointed in him, in fact. He's now got a videotape he's selling behind the counter, which is close to child pornography. And it's the two men that we're introduced to, Robbie and Cecil, are sad that he's joined the modern times. But we find, of course, that Min Mortimer himself is doing local films with orphan girls. It's not an attractive place. There's no reason for anybody to go there except rough and kind of manly fishermen who are trying to get away from everything back at the office or the hardware store or wherever.
You grew up in Mississippi. You still live in Mississippi. What are some of the things you think most separate Southern culture from Northern culture?
Oh, God. They're still relatively unhurried here when you get out of the big urban centers like Nashville and Atlanta, which are very cosmopolitan now. They're very much like a lot of the nation. But there's a world of difference between a football crowd and at a Vandy Ole Miss game and a Penn State crowd. I can tell by experience. There is just a leisure about the culture and a kind of love of jokes and especially old times. People in the South are nostalgic by age 11. And I say that in the book, but it's not a joke. It's looking back even to poverty as a great old time. We have a great yearning for a softer, quieter, kinder times. I think we're just afflicted with that Irish look at the past as a comfort and a joy. And we celebrate the past a great deal more than other places.
Did you grow up reading a lot of the literature of the South? Did the fact that you were from the South affect your choices in what to read or the things that you were assigned in school?
I did not read the literature of the South. I only heard the great names spoken, Eudora Welty, William Faulkner, Tennessee Williams. I was not literary a bit, frankly, until I went to high school. I got a high school class and started reading some Keats. And then I think next was Jack London. So I'm a schooled literary man. It wasn't just instantly available in the house.
What was it about Keats that did it for you?
I think it was the Ode on a Grecian Urn, and I had such a good teacher, Mrs. Lois Blackwell, that made that thing come alive, and I could see the joy in language and how somebody could get rapturous over beauty. And also knowing that he died at 26 interested me because I was like 17, and that seemed like a pretty decent lifespan then. You know, and so you just get the move on. You can get your poems in, die at 26 and be famous. So that was actually kind of inviting to the stupid boy in school like me.
Have you ever gone through a real dry period writing where it just wouldn't come and you gave up?
Yes. But I think that's what it's good to teach and have a regular paycheck. Because I go for some months without inspiration, and it frightens me. It frightens me deeply. Nobody wants to be out of gas. Nobody wants to repeat himself. So these are frightening times, and I was keeping a journal to try to help myself. I've heard that it helps, but my journal was full of such banal thoughts. I wouldn't dare let anybody read them. I'm just like taking out the dog, and it's raining today, and I had no great thoughts unless I was working. And that's the way it's been. I just don't think my thoughts are very average, ordinary. Until I get among people and language, I think I do have some thoughts then, and there's my real work, my mental life. You just wait out these periods. I think it's good. You know, there are already too many books, and you want to save it until you're ready and you can do your best. And then when those days come, that's just a wonderful feeling, because you got to get up at 4 in the morning and full of joy go into those notebooks, and I just feel like I'm the luckiest man in the world.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
You bet.
Barry Hanna recorded last July when his novel Yonder Stands Your Orphan was first published. It's just come out in paperback. The title refers to a line in this Bob Dylan song. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you better grab it fast. Yonder stands your orphan with his gun, crying like a fire in the sun. Look out, the saints are coming through, and it's all over now, baby blue.